Hey everybody, welcome to the fifth episode. It is fifth, right? That sounds right. Fifth episode.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, I knew it. Alright, yeah, I'm Joe Ryan, your host. This is GRCast, in case I didn't say that. Probably kind of important to mention. You know, if you downloaded this thing, you know what it is. Come on. And like last
should
week,
we take
I joined...
it? Should we do take...
Terrible. Terrible. Not off to a great start, fella. I'm not
you
editing
might
wait,
no. This is the GRCast? I thought this was for IGN. You didn't tell me it was for Game Reviews.
I forgot that we've been lying to Charles the whole time. We should have thought of that first. Whoops. Well, as you've probably heard, I am joined today by Charles and Matt.
Hey.
Hello.
We're going to try and actually get to a topic this week. So I think we're going to try and get through what you've been playing a lot quicker. If I sound like garbage, it is due to the fact that what I've been playing is Dead Island Riptide, and when I've been playing it was most of the night.
That... And I've had a similar experience with Bioshock all week.
Yes. Yes. We're planning, by the time you hear this, we are planning on recording a special episode that is just a discussion about Bioshock Infinite, probably mostly discussion about the ending, that sort of thing, but maybe some of the game mechanics and everything too. That'll probably be sometime next week because I don't have a ton of free time coming up here. But we'll work out the details. Before episode 6, that will probably be out. That is my guess. So you can look forward to that. I guess I could go first since I already mentioned Dead Island, a game that is excellent. If you liked Dead Island 1, if you didn't like Dead Island 1, you're going to load this game up and go, this looks and plays just like the original Dead Island, which is all I wanted from it, and it is all it does. So I think that's okay.
If you don't like the original Dead Island, you sound like some sort of English supervillain. This is exactly like what I expected from Dead Island 1!
I know, Matt, you said you didn't care for... You didn't like Dead Island because you didn't like the melee combat system, right?
I didn't mind it. To be honest, Blockbuster has just gone bust over here and pretty much completely gone, and they were doing PC games for £2 a piece. So I went down there and I picked up a load, and I didn't play it as much as perhaps I should have done, but it felt almost like a MMO in the way it was structured, and it really didn't work for me. Perhaps it needed to be a little more linear. I don't know, but I didn't like the mission structure, and that put me off a lot.
Well, that MMO-style mission structure worked really well for Skyrim. And I think Dead Island, the original Dead Island was one of the first games to really try a mostly single-player experience that, you know, apes what you do in a MMO.
Yeah, I think that probably sounds right.
I think the difference between Skyrim and Dead Island, though, was that Skyrim, all the optional missions, they kind of, there was supposed to be like an infinite amount of things that you could do, or rather it just kept going and going and going, but there was still kind of a linear path, whereas with Dead Island, I seem to feel like you needed to do so much to progress, even though it was basically just too open, whereas Skyrim had that linearity to a certain extent.
To me, the difference between the original Dead Island and Skyrim was the fact that after I played Dead Island, I could not play Skyrim as a melee character. Like, when I played as... Who did I play as? I don't even remember. I played as everybody in the original Dead Island. I played all four of those characters. And it was like, you smack a zombie with something and an arm comes off or a head comes off or they react like they got hit with a wrench and stumble around and everything. And then you get Skyrim and I'm carrying a two-handed hammer and I hit a guy in the face and nothing happens but his life bar goes down. And I just repeat that until he dies. I went, if this game didn't have such an excellent archery system, I don't think I could play it.
You played Zombie U, didn't you, Joe?
I did, but I'm too old at this point to play games that frustrate the shit out of me, so I stopped.
Your precious life is ticking away.
Yeah, I have limited time to play games, and when I play them, I want to enjoy them. It's the same reason I... Oh god, this is an embarrassing reveal on the air. I don't know if I should say this, but I'm going to anyway. I have not beaten the demo for Metal Gear Rising. Like, I was planning on buying this game because I was like, it's Metal Gear Rising, you get a sword, it looks so awesome. I haven't beaten the demo, because I can't. I can't beat it. Like, it's too difficult. I told Matt when I first downloaded it, like, the first day it was available, I got to some robot dog man who had blades coming out of impossible places or whatever. It was stupid, stupid character design like Metal Gear always has. And I could not beat that guy.
I love the robot dog.
That guy must have kicked my ass for like an hour and a half, and I went, this is ridiculous. I can't figure this out. So then, like 2 weeks ago, I loaded it up again. Yeah, that's the trouble. I don't like to block in anything. And if I do like to block, I want a block button, not a press towards them and press the attack button at the same time just as they're about to hit you. No, thank you. 2 weeks ago, I loaded that game up again. I was like, I'm going to beat that fucking robot dog. Couldn't get to him. Couldn't even get to him. I just kept dying.
There's a DLC pack coming out where you get to play as the robot dog. So maybe if you get the full game, you can run around as the dog and take your vengeance on those humans.
Yeah, see, that maybe that's the trouble. Maybe the dog is where it's at. That's the problem. I'm too much in the mind of a dog when I'm playing that game for some reason.
You know, the really funny thing is that I got this email saying, oh, have you tried it? Have you tried it? And he said that he couldn't finish that dog. So I sent a huge list of ways to beat it, that you had a block and that you had to use health. And I got an email back like one sentence saying, yeah, I should try some of that. He hadn't been using the nano paste or whatever it's called. He hadn't been blocking. He'd just been running at it and trying to hit it. That was the extent of his strategy.
That's essentially true. When I play a demo of a game, here's how it works. I skip all cutscenes and all information they give me because I don't care. It's a demo. So I just walk in and press buttons until it's over.
But that is a great way of making a demo last few months. So you've got something there anyway.
Well, when I loaded it up the other day, my plan was use some of your tactics you gave me to beat that damn wolfman, and I couldn't even get to him. So I give up. That's just not a game I'm ever going to play, and I've accepted that now.
If you think that was hard, you would cry at the last boss. And now I know we can't really talk about it, but it is just ridiculously difficult.
The final boss is the embodiment of the industrial military complex, and it takes forever to beat him.
Ridiculous. My biggest problem, I'm going to try and make an excuse now for why I'm so bad at it. I immediately try to go into whatever it is, sword mode, where I turn people into pieces of people, because that's all I want to do in that game. I don't want to play. If I wanted to play Bayonetta, I'd play Bayonetta, but what I want to do is turn men into soup. So I immediately start trying to do that as soon as I find anyone. And for some reason, as soon as I activate that mode, I feel like all of the controls are suddenly backwards. I cannot control where he's looking, where that sword is supposed to be going, and I have tried again and again, and I cannot get my head around the controls as soon as that mode is activated.
I think there's something in the options where you have to set the way that the camera goes, but there's two different options. There's one for when you're just regularly running around, and then there's one for when you enter the sword mode. So maybe you've mixed up the actual, whether it's inverted or not.
Probably. Well, it's like...
Yeah, and there's interesting...
Go ahead.
Sorry. There's a... You know, it uses a strange mechanic where when you aim with the sword using the analog stick, you strike when you release the stick, not when you move the stick.
These are all things that are probably important. Like, all I know is that... I think... Correct me if I'm wrong. This might be my excuse. Is that I think when you enter that sword mode, the camera that you would normally control with the right stick suddenly becomes the left stick because the right stick is controlling the sword now. And for some reason, me moving the camera with the left stick while trying to aim that sword with the right one, it's just not happening.
You could hold your controller upside down.
Now that's what I should do. Charles is onto it. He knows what's going on. I'm the only one in the world who will have to jump through these hoops. Forget it. I'm just not going to play it.
You didn't read that page in the instruction manual where it said to hold your controller upside down?
Oh, yeah, I must have missed that when I downloaded the demo, and then they sent me that guide in the mail, and they said, now that you've downloaded our demo, you need our arcane instructions to figure that shit out. And I said, I'm not going to read any instructions. I just want to play a demo. I want to have fun. I want to get done with it so I can buy the full game, and now I'm not going to because it sucks.
Well, the full game is nearly twice as long as the demo, so you're really losing out.
Oh, so I'm missing out on all the fun. But that, why are we talking about this game? I'm talking about a demo of a game I can't beat when I should be talking about a full game I do enjoy called Dead Island Riptide. Wow, we are off topic already. I'm not going to derail this thing
so
too much
more. So
tell
me about the multiplayer.
I would tell you about the multiplayer if I did not have satellite internet. I will tell you about the single player if you want to hear about that. The single player is good. It's Dead Island.
Yes, I do.
It's in a different place. And I don't know what else to say about it. What I was going to say about it was, Matt, if you want to play this game and enjoy it, the key to enjoying this game a lot is to play Logan. He's the guy who throws things, and all you do is sit there and throw knives all day. It's great. That's my favorite part of that game.
Wasn't there something like that in Aladdin on the Sega Genesis? I you know, if I wanted to throw things around, there are so many options that have, you know, entertainment value.
I know he threw apples in one of the versions of that game. That might have been Super Nintendo one. Maybe he threw swords that were like covered in blood and the viscera of children or something in Sega, because Sega was the demon version of Nintendo at that time, right? I don't want to get too much into it. My review is going to be coming up for Dead Island. It's looking like probably tomorrow is when I'll be doing it, because I need to play it more today, a lot more, hopefully. But I like it. It's out. I can say it's good. It's good. If you like Dead Island 1, if you like throwing knives at zombies and for some reason their arms and legs come off and then you get a bunch of loot for it, I don't know where else you can get that experience. Who wants to go? Who wants to take up what they've been playing? Just hit like your top game you've been playing, and then so we can get to an actual topic this week.
I've been playing nothing but BioShock Infinite since our last podcast. I went into this thinking, well, I'll play an hour or two a day every day for the next couple of weeks, and then, you know, 25 hours later, I'm finished.
Yeah,
and
that
now
one...
I'm going through my second playthrough.
Are you playing it on 1999 mode?
I played a little of 1999 mode, but I decided I'd play through first on normal mode, then I'd do another playthrough on hard mode, and then at the very end, I'll play through yet a third time on 1999 mode.
I thought the interesting thing, after I beat the original game on normal or whatever it was, I looked up the info about 1999 mode, and apart from being a lot harder, which is why I'll never play it, they said, you don't have all of these options anymore, like changing your different upgrades and stuff you bought. And I thought, I didn't know those were options the first time I played. I just bought the upgrades I bought and stuck with them the whole time.
Yeah, that actually stayed with me, too. And that's actually one of the very few complaints that I do have about the game is the way that the upgrade system works. In the previous BioShock games, your character had a bunch of different kinds of resources, but now you just have money, and money is used to upgrade your guns, it's used to upgrade your vigors, which is what the plasmids are called in the new game, and it's also used to buy supplies. So you have to really choose, you know, what you're going to upgrade at any particular moment.
I thought the original BioShock, and maybe BioShock 2, I don't remember 2 enough, one of the things they did a little bit better was that you sort of had the sense of ownership over your guns, because they let you carry, I think they just let you carry every gun in the game, and then as you upgraded it, it changed the look. You would actually see him add a little bit of wiring or whatever. I mean, it wasn't anything super exciting, but it was like, oh yeah, I'm upgrading my gun. You can actually see that it's upgraded, and now that you can only carry 2 guns, they didn't bother doing that, because it's like you're just grabbing a different machine gun off of a dead man every 15 minutes. I understand why they didn't do it. It's just, it's not as cool as the first time around.
Yeah, and of course, every machine gun you pick up now has the upgrades of the one that you upgraded earlier in the game. And actually, speaking of that, one of the few complaints that I do have is that some of the guns are virtually useless without upgrades, and other guns are just terrific because they're so highly specialized. Like, the machine gun is practically worthless as soon as you pick it up, and it's not until you put a few upgrades in that you can really use it functionally. But the shotgun or sniper rifle, you know, you can use those to very great effect without any upgrades at all, because they're so well suited to the tactical uses that they're designed for, like close range and long range.
Yeah, I thought they did a pretty good job with a lot of the weapons that are, like you said, they're specifically for one thing. But then the weapons like machine gun, assault rifle, or whatever, it's like, this is just an all-around type weapon, and then you just shoot guys for days, and they don't seem to care that much.
Yeah, on the harder difficulty modes, aiming a machine gun or a pistol at someone, you're just slowly watching that bar nip down, like he's being nibbled to death by mice.
This is why I don't play games on hard. I don't know if I've ever mentioned it. When games are hard, I don't like it.
No, but BioShock Infinite definitely warrants being played through a second time on some difficulty level. The first time around, I missed a lot of little things, and now the second time around, I'm really seeing how they were hinting at all the story twists that are coming.
Yeah, I think BioShock Infinite is better than the original BioShock for the second playthrough. Like we talked about last week in the first BioShock, when you replay it, it's just, oh, how many times did he use the code phrase to make me do something? In BioShock Infinite, it's like mind expanding to play that a second time.
Yeah, especially hearing all the things that the Ludus twins are leaving in their audio logs, you're suddenly like, oh, I get what she meant by mixing our peas with our porridge.
Right. We're gonna end up.
Spoilers. I know the whole story now.
Yeah, you shouldn't have said anything. It's all about food.
Yeah, a Booker wakes up and finds out that he's just been drowning in a bowl of porridge throughout this whole thing, and it's just been one long metaphor inside his head.
Oh, that would have been a good game too. You know what? If that had been the twist,
And
I'd probably think that was amazing. I'm easily led, I
if
guess.
Irrational Games is hiring, I'm available.
And hungry, apparently.
BioShock Porridge.
With BioShock Infinite, I'm super excited to see what the DLC packs are. I'm very interested to find out what how that's going to work.
I kind of feel that with every the deeper that we get into this BioShock 2 Infinite conversation, the shorter the next podcast is getting.
Now, the next podcast is going to be us all trying to unravel the very complicated story behind it, and we will yammer on for hours, showing how we read our philosophy and how terribly clever we are.
That's true. It's going to be a bunch of people who think they're smarter than they are trying to outsmart each other, which sounds great fun to me because I'll be there. And if all goes well, I'm planning on having like audio clips to back up what I'm saying and everything. I'm going to put on a show, gentlemen. Matt, you won't be there to enjoy it.
I'm not going to listen to it for ages, so it's kind of wasted on me.
As
Oh,
long as
well,
you
here's
listen to
some
it someday.
non-spoiler stuff.
Yeah, go for it.
Well, here's some tangential BioShock information that's not full of spoilers. It's heavily inspired by the 1893 Chicago Fair, as I'm sure you all know. And I've been reading a book called Devil in the White City, which is a historical crime novel set during the Chicago World's Fair. And so it's really fun, reading that book simultaneously while playing through the game and seeing all these little allusions to, actual historical events within the game.
It's nice that they've put that extra effort in, but I looked through the art book and I'm not surprised that they did because they definitely know their sources. They definitely do a lot of research and build upon that, which doesn't always happen for video games.
Well, that's getting back to the original concept behind the first BioShock game of making the setting part of the story, making Rapture essentially a character in itself. And the same holds true for Columbia.
Yeah, I think that the city is as important as anything, if not more so. Just going and seeing the world that they've built, it for me is like half or 75% of the fun in those games. Well, Matt, what have you been up to? Let's get through this. Tell us about what Scarlet Blade, right?
No, repetitive strain injury. I can't play that game anymore.
That's the Naked Women MMO game.
That's right, yeah. Now this week I've
Or
been
so I hear.
this week I've been this is the first week where I've played more than one game all the way through. I've been playing Dota 2, Counter-Strike Global Offensive, BioShock 2, and a game on the Vita that came out yesterday here, and then I think in the States on Tuesday called Draw Slasher. And I'll just quickly go through each of them, I guess. Draw Slasher is it's a sequel to an iOS game where you literally everything is touch screen. You're a little ninja, and you have to fight pirate monkey zombies, and there's different types, and you have to slash them in different ways via this touch screen. And it's a good game actually. It's quite fun. There's a reviewer that come in, if not today, then tomorrow. And it sounds like it would be a fairly cheap kind of iOS, just kind of shovelware basically. But it's not. It's actually quite good fun, and it's quite cheap as well on the PlayStation Store. And it's got trophies and challenges. And it's well worth checking out if you've been on them and are on about it. And of course, yeah, there's a review coming. By the time this is out, the review will be up. BioShock 2 is not as good as BioShock 1, but I do like going through it. And, it's nice to see that there's a line that Fontaine says in one of the audio diaries in the first one about that all these people came to Rapture expecting to be top of the pyramid. And they don't realize that there's people that still have to sweep up and cook and that sort of thing. And BioShock 2, to me, kind of builds on that in a lot of ways, which is interesting. It's just a shame that the flaws in the gameplay seem worse than in the first one. Dota 2, I've been playing more of that. It's always nice to play with nice people. The MOBA genre is well known for its hospitality. I still haven't. I still haven't committed suicide or anything, which is surprising considering some of the nice things people have said to me. I was talking to someone the other day. He was he had one kill, one assist, and 10 deaths, and he spent the whole game telling the rest of the team that the reason that he had that many deaths was because we all sucked. And I told him to shut the hell up, and he blocked me and then carried on moaning. So it's nice that he'd played over 500 games. And he still sucked that badly. So yeah, nice people. And
Well, in his defense, he probably had an inferior monitor cable that didn't keep his refresh rate up fast enough.
it was that. It was definitely that. Oh, this guy. Like, I've been really happy with Dota this last week. I've had at least two games where the people I've been playing with have been really supportive of everyone else. They've been on the microphones. They've been really good. And then in between those two games, there was just this one person. Who he even started going into like the overall chat and telling everyone else what we were doing just so that the game would end quicker. And he really thought that he was this amazing pro player. And oh, it was enough to make me consider never playing that game again. It was just frustrating. And Global Offensive is almost the same now. I bought it when it first came out, and I was really, really good at it. I was like, people say this is a hardcore shooter. No way, this is easy. Anyway, in the time since, it seems like everyone that was just kind of casually playing it's quit, and now only professionals play it because I don't. I've been playing it for about a week, and I think I've had two kills, and it is ridiculous. Like, you cannot move in that game. There must be ways of specifically moving, and I know. Peering around corners and very gradually moving and that sort of thing. But there must be very specific, a bit like a game of like football or something, that there's very specific runs that your team can make that are definitely going to win. And everyone that plays in a team now knows those ways of winning, and it's almost frustrating. But I keep playing, even though I spend 90% of my time watching other people get murdered. It's still very, very addictive.
That what you say about how they have basically plays that they run, like they would have in American football or whatever. There's this fascinating book you guys might want to read called Game Boys, I think it is, and it's literally about the top two Counter-Strike teams from, I forget which Counter-Strike game it was, the one that all the old hardcore people think is the greatest or whatever. And it's about the two different teams and sort of the things they get up to when they're not playing, and then it follows their lives. It's like a documentary book or whatever about the different players and how they are and the game they play and their managers and everything. And it is fascinating. But that is exactly what they do, is they come up with, they have like a playbook, and they practice by running these plays. You need to get to your mark in X amount of time from the place where you start, and if a guy comes this way, you need to smoke him out first, hit him with a flashbang or whatever, then the other guy's going to jump over a box and shoot him down, and then at the end of that round, you better have this amount of money because you need to buy this weapon for round two. I mean, it's really, really intense.
I can believe it. I can definitely believe it. But you know, there's one great thing about playing Counter-Strike again, and that's that there's this kind of novelty player called Ahab the Arab, and it is like the most racist thing ever. He goes on and kind of starts each game by going, "Ah," and he's always on the terrorist team, and he'll randomly, every time he dies, he'll just kind of say, "Allah, it was Allah's will," and I keep
Wait,
coming.
how do you know that he's a role player? I mean, maybe he really is with Al Qaeda.
Maybe he is, but the funny thing about it is, there's not been a single game where I've come across him where he hasn't, someone hasn't tried to kick him. But he's such a good player that his own team always votes to keep him, despite the fact that he's this kind of, either, yes, a suicide bomber, or just kind of a crazy, novelty account. He always is voted to stay because he pretty much carries the team no matter what. It's absolutely amazing to watch.
That is cool, the idea of an internet character or something that people know. Another one I heard about that I thought was really interesting was what is it? It's the zombie mod for Arma 2. I think it's DayZ, maybe. Which one is it? I forget. There's another game that's like a full
Easy,
game.
yes, it's
Yeah, there's another
terrific.
one that's like a rip-off of that or something that's a full game and everybody hates it. But I heard about how there was a
Yeah,
in
that's
the
called the War Z.
Yeah, that's the one. Okay, so that one's garbage. DayZ, the mod, is the good one. And I had heard that there was a character who was a female player who they is known now as the Black Widow because she will get on the mic and she acts like, just a damsel in distress. She calls out to the guys in the area like, "Help, I'm in trouble," or whatever. And gamers, being the idiots that they are, they rush over to help the girl. And when they get there, she fucking murders them and takes all their stuff. It's like people know her now on there. That is
I better
cool to
go and
me.
help her because I might get sex out of this some way. I don't know how, but it might happen.
That's got to be what people think, right? I don't get it. I don't understand it.
I'll
But
save her
man.
from the zombies and get laid. I see the logic there.
That is exactly how it works.
Well, she's my favorite person on the internet probably right now because if you can take gamers and make them look stupid, it's not a challenge, but it is funny every time.
Now that we've lost half of our listener base.
Yeah, what listener base? We're, this is purely a selfish exercise for me. I'm the only one listening to it.
My girlfriend listens occasionally.
Ah, there we go.
My wife and one of my cats.
Look at
It's
that.
depressing
Just
that not your
one of
cats
the
are up for it.
cats.
Well, I think that wraps it up for what we've been playing. So I know that the big thing we want to touch on today is based on an article Matt wrote called "The Pros and Cons of Blocking the Secondhand Market," and it's sort of the whole idea of the used games and GameStop and that thing have been a big discussion for the past, what, like 2 years now, just because of the rise of digital downloads and the suggestion that maybe in the future some consoles won't allow you to play used games due to an always-on internet connection, or maybe you'd have to put in a product key like you've done with PC games in the past for years now. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the article, Matt, what went into writing it, and then sort of give your opinion on the whole used market thing, and we'll just have a little round table from there.
Okay. So really, I do have to stress with the title, there are pros and cons. No one is going to be 100% behind either option because, there is every chance that the end user is going to get screwed over if the used market is blocked. But there's also every reason to think that it could end up in the long run being the best option because most people don't really realize how much power the brick and mortar stores have over the gaming industry. Most people, because it only really came out this time last year when in the UK, game was going through bankruptcy and all that sort of thing. A lot of publishers, thinking that game was going to disappear, made pretty damning statements about the fact that they'd threatened, when Steam was still in its first few years, that they'd threatened not to carry any PC game that had Steam capabilities. And even up until a few years ago, they were refusing to sell games that used Steam as DRM because Steam would undersell game when it came to the summer sale or the winter sale. So
the bi-monthly sale.
Yeah. the weekly wallet empty. That's right. And, you know, the amount of power that these stores have is ridiculous because they can say, if we don't like it, we're not going to sell your game. And if we could get rid of the used market, that just wouldn't be an issue anymore. And the price on digital items would go down. And you wouldn't be going in and buying a new copy and getting a used copy. Like, you know, there's a million stories. It might, you know, it sounds like the sort of thing where someone's just gone onto a forum and started complaining. But knowing people that have worked for these companies and knowing that they can take a game home before it comes out, play it for 2 days, bring it back, and then it'll be sold as new, there is no reason to think that's a good thing. And with the lack of power that blocking the used industry would give them, that they would perhaps start being a little more humble and they would start selling things that perhaps, you know, they don't have to sell vague titles because someone will trade them in, and then they don't have to buy any directly from the publisher and things like that, you know. So that's a big part of it. But more than that, it's the sort of thing that's just eventually going to happen. So we kind of have to work out the best way of doing it now and figure where things could go wrong and try and avoid those pitfalls, I think.
Well, there are some people I have talked to, a lot of my friends that I know in real life, the few that I have, who really think that will not ever happen, that home consoles are always going to have some physical media, be it a disc or a tiny little memory card or whatever, and that you will just always be able to buy them, sell them, do whatever you want with them. And I just fundamentally disagree. I think the way this generation has gone, the writing is on the wall that someday games, they're just going to be downloaded. That's all. There's you're going to be your only choice. If you want to play a game, you download it. I mean, is that what you guys think, or do you think there's going to be a physical option forever?
I think there'll be a physical option forever, but it'll be rare and inconvenient. It'll be like trying to get your phone company to send you a paper bill, or your bank send you a paper bill that, you know, a few years ago, it was inconceivable that everybody would be using online banking, and now the banks are constantly pressuring you with, you know, oh, we'll send you a copy of your bill for an extra $15 fee. And so I think that's going to happen, that if you want to buy the new Call of Duty, you can have, you can go into the store and there will be a handful of, you know, physical new discs that you can buy for your PlayStation 5.
I think that's probably going to happen this next generation, actually. I mean, if we're looking 6 or 7 years into the future, because the downside of that is that the console manufacturers will be spending money putting in a disk drive for people not to use it, and it's money that they'll want to save to either put somewhere else or to get the price down. But, you know, I do think that we're heading towards a digital future, and I do think that gamers aren't necessarily the most open-minded of people. They are, you know, you go back 20 years, I think most people would have been happy with SNES-style graphics and chiptune music. And, you know, it's only the developers have to push innovations, even if people are resistant to them. And I do think that it ends up not becoming an inconvenience necessarily, but it becomes accepted and then utilized and then celebrated almost.
I do think that we're going to see a cloud storage bubble and high-speed internet bubble that's going to pop in a few years, that so many people are going to jump on this concept of an always-on device that's constantly downloading very large files. And, you know, every gadget in your house and in your pocket is going to be doing this. And I think we're eventually going to see a bubble where so many people are jumping on the bandwagon so quickly that there's a mass exodus from it. But I don't think that's going to happen for, like, another technology generation, maybe 10 years from now.
I think, and I mean, I don't I don't really know enough about the process of actually kind of connecting to the internet, like the physical process of it. But I do remember reading not long ago that there is this kind of huge untapped potential in the cable that we already have, to the point where very little of what we're actually connecting to is kind of the full potential of what we could connect to. And I mean, there's proof of that to a certain extent in that the Google internet, wherever that was, Kansas, I think, I don't know, but they opened their fiber optic internet, and Time Warner, I think, basically flipped a switch and doubled the speed that people were getting to compete with the newly opened Google internet. And I do think that yes, more people connecting is going to be a bad thing, but I think that there's the potential there to easily cope with that.
Here's my question. Supposing that we do go either to an all-digital future or just a future where things are mostly digital and the physical is sort of an afterthought, do you guys think that we are headed more towards the cloud streaming of games? I mean, some people have said that the OnLive and Gaikai and that sort of thing work really well already. And I mean, internet speeds are only going to get better. I can't imagine that they're not going to be able to sort of perfect that thing. Or do you think it'll be more like we're downloading games and keeping them? I kind of think that the downloading them will be the concession for people. Maybe you'll have a choice of both or something, but it's like, well, you don't get a physical disc anymore, but at least you get a download that's all yours instead of just playing someone else's game on someone else's system from 2,000 miles away or whatever.
I think that both are going to be very common. We've already heard that the PlayStation 4 might be using an OnLive kind of system for backwards compatibility. So if you want to play your PlayStation 3 or 2 or PSP games on your PlayStation 4, you'll really just be streaming the video over from another server that's playing the game. And so I think that that is going to become very common, especially on the consoles. I think it'll be less likely for PCs, but I do think that consoles and probably mobile devices are going to find that to be a really tempting option.
And I think further to that, I think you can't really judge how well cloud gaming is going to work by what we've got now. I think it's absolutely fantastic. I've been using it for over a year. On the day that it came out, I interviewed Steve Perlman, who was then CEO of OnLive, and there was million, well, not millions, but there was a lot of people logging in, pretty much servers to capacity around the Eurogamer convention and across the UK, and he showed me on an iPad the real-time statistics, and it was working well for most of them. And there was people logging in from France and Russia and places where they needed kind of VPNs to log in or whatever. And it was working well then. And the impression that I got was that they'd be able to compress the data more, and they'd be able to deliver it more quickly as time went on. And so I think that a lot of the people that are kind of saying that they're not up for it, or that it won't work, and I don't own any of my games, blah, 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 they don't really understand what they're talking about. But again, they've spoken to someone on a forum, and the person on the forum has brought up a good point, and they've just repeated that point time and time again without actually trying the service for themselves. And I think that until the PS4 comes out, it's hard to judge how well people are going to kind of adapt to it.
Well, as tablets start becoming more common, we're going to start seeing more people replacing their desktop and laptop computer with a tablet that isn't going to be capable of playing, the hot new game. So for people that are trying to rebuild their entertainment lives around having just a tablet computer and a television set-top box, then, the cloud gaming is going to be really, a really good solution for getting high quality gaming on some crappy little device that, hasn't necessarily been upgraded the way that a hardcore PC gamer is going to upgrade their rig.
Yeah, that's what excites me about cloud gaming in general, is just the idea that I can have a crappy computer, which is the only type of computer I've essentially ever had, and I can play a game that is like way out of the league of my computer if I can connect to the server. I mean, satellite internet, that's not going to be happening for me, gentlemen. Enjoy the future while I'm here in the 1800s. But I know for a fact that if they want me to go all digital, say that, you know, they're probably going to be leaning pretty heavily on downloadable stuff for PS4. You can already get almost every new release game downloaded on the PlayStation Store for PS3 right now. I know they've said you can play the game as it's downloading on PS4, and that's good. That's a great step for people. But what Steam does frequently, or maybe you can do it with every game, is if you pre-order it, they will let you download 99% of the game, and then at midnight on release, they release that last 1%, and at 12:01, you're playing your game already. If I can do that on consoles to where I can download almost the entire thing in the weeks leading up to it, and then midnight, they just flip the switch, and bam, I'm ready to go instantly because I just download the last 10 kilobytes or whatever. That's what I want for digital future.
I might be wrong, but I'm sure you can already do that with the PS3 pre-orders. I've never used the service, but I'm sure that's a big pull of it.
Yeah, I've never bought a full game on there either, I don't think. So maybe you can. Maybe if you pre-order it. Wow, that would be great. Why haven't I been doing that, if that's the case?
The future's already here.
We're supposed to be experts in the field of video games, and we don't know what the hell we're talking about. We need to look this up. I'm not going to look it up. I'll take your word for it. Go ahead, Charles.
Well, about Steam, with the whole concept of going digital entirely and used games, for years you haven't been able to resell your PC games. Because once you buy even if you buy a physical disc in a store, it'll give you an unlockable code for some digital distributor like Steam or Origin or one of the competing ones. So you haven't been able to resell your PC games for a really long time, and consoles are going to be heading into a similar economic structure. But what we've seen with the PC games is that you do see gigantic price breaks, even on games that you can't resell. Steam in particular, it's BioShock Infinite, it's going to be going for, $15 within a year and a half.
I've seen BioShock Infinite for a tenner, so $13.
Wow.
Already.
See, so that's, in my opinion, the whole idea of if there's no used market games, the price will never come down. It's absurd. Because on Steam, you can already get a brand new game. That game's going to be $60 on consoles for, the next year probably, or for quite a while. And we have a used market. On the computer, there is no used market, and you can buy that game for $10. I wish I had a computer where I could just buy all my games for, a nickel.
I think it comes down to the fact that, developers would rather you bought their game for, $10 than that you went and bought it pre-owned or that you pirated it. I do think they'd rather have something than nothing, and I think that getting rid of the used game side of things, you would start seeing more and more instances of them offering you opportunities to buy it far below what you expected to buy it for.
Well, it's sort of the same thing on a smaller scale. The music industry sort of went through the same thing. I mean, when I was slightly younger, nobody paid for music. I just downloaded everything I want for free. I didn't even consider it. And then they, I don't know if iTunes necessarily started it or other sites, but then they were like, don't steal it. Just if you want a song, just pay like a dollar. And it's like, well, for a dollar, it's not even worth stealing. I'll give them a buck for a song. I think that's fair. And they're still making plenty of money on it. The artists seem fine with it. They're making something instead of nothing. It's good for everyone.
And now there are services like Spotify as well, which of course people can just listen to the music they want for free with occasional ad breaks.
Yeah, and actually the iPhone's gaming iStore has a lot in common with the way that Steam works too, because just about any game that launches on the iPhone is going to eventually have a special sale or a big price break. So even though you can't resell those and don't have any physical version of it, we're still seeing that the games do drop in value for customers that can just hold out for it.
And we have said now that you can't resell, but there's actually a lawsuit happening in Germany right now against Steam because you can't resell your games. So if Valve pay attention to this lawsuit, or if they're banned from selling in Germany or whatever, then a lot of other digital distributors are going to pay attention to the outcome of that and change their system accordingly. There's sites, Green Man Gaming, I want to say, where you can resell your license and get some points back towards other games. And if Microsoft can implement that sort of system for the next Xbox or whenever this happens, I don't really see that there's an awful lot to complain about. You're still getting some back, and you can use that on whatever you want.
To me, that's absurd. That is frustrating to me in the extreme. The idea of I bought something on Steam or wherever, you probably paid almost nothing for it because who pays full price for things on Steam? And then later you're crying about it and trying to sell it back to somebody. I can't imagine that Steam doesn't come out of this lawsuit and have to make zero changes because to me it is ridiculous. But I've been surprised before.
I think their attitude so far has been just ignore it, largely. I don't think I've ever seen a quote from Steam, from Valve, or any of the people that work on Steam actually commenting on it. But it is an interesting lawsuit because it will end up affecting what we're discussing now. You know, how much do you own when you buy something digitally? How long can you download it for? If you paid something and it's no longer on the servers, where is it? Now, if this lawsuit ends up working out properly, I could, in theory, sell the license of a game that they no longer have on the servers and not have to worry about where's that game gone? I've got nothing for my money.
I guess that's sort of true, but if you're just selling a license to a game that's not on the servers anymore, where are they going to download it? I mean, do they somehow come and they take that info for the game files off your computer, and they send that in an email to the guy who purchased it, or what?
Well, I guess no one will actually be able to purchase it. It's just there's a kind of line of defense between you and you losing all your stuff. They'll just have to give you money because you own it, and that's it. You know, they'll just there has to be some way of knowing that the thing that you've bought isn't just going to disappear.
Is that a problem we have in any other area, or is it just games? I mean, when I buy anything, it just comes with the realization that someday it's going to be obsolete. I don't have a problem with that. When I buy Call of Duty every year, I don't think, oh, geez, I don't know if I should even buy this, because in 23 years, if I want to play Call of Duty Black Ops 2, I don't know if the servers will still be on.
I think that the part of the problem is that people are so resistant to change, and you know they'll come up with any reason. You know, there's a big thing going around now that oh, they shouldn't block the used game industry because it helps with sequels, because people who buy the first game at dirt cheap might buy the second game full price. And you know, that's valid so long as you presume that anyone who bought the game dirt cheap will buy a sequel full price, instead of just waiting a week and then buying it for $5 off used. And I do wonder how many of these people that repeat this and repeat it and repeat it think beyond, I don't want this to happen, and these are the reasons that I don't want it to happen.
Well, regarding the sequels, it seems that there's a trend where every time the big new game comes out, Big New Game Part 1 always ends up getting, HD re-release, or it's, marked down on Steam as a promotion, or, in the old days they used to release, the greatest hits edition of it. So I don't think that sequel argument holds water whatsoever.
I'm frustrated with the sequel
You know,
argument as well because the one I always famously use is Mirror's Edge, where I don't know anybody who played Mirror's Edge and didn't think it was a cool game. But every single person I know waited and they bought it used for dirt cheap or whatever, and they're like, I can't, oh, I'm so excited, I can't wait for Mirror's Edge 2. Guess what? There is no Mirror's Edge 2. They didn't make any money on it because only 10 people bought it, and then they resold it to GameStop and to everyone else who wanted to play it. GameStop made $1 million off that game, and the guys who made it made a nickel.
And that's the problem. That's what, people will say, oh, well, you don't find people complaining. You don't find Ford complaining when I sell on my car. And it's not really the same sort of thing. It's a poor argument because, first of all, Ford made their money when you bought that car. If you go and spend 15 grand on a car, they have covered everything that's gone into that car. If you go and spend $60 on a game and only three people bought it, then that game has been a complete failure.
Well, also, the game doesn't wear out in the way that buying a used car or buying vintage clothing, you're getting, you know, a worn-out product.
Yeah, and I mean, further to that, it's famous, of course, that as soon as you drive the car off the lot, the value halves. Whereas if I go and buy a game, a game brand new, then I could probably get most of that money back if I traded it back in. And then they can just charge almost as much to get it, to sell. You know, they're going to be selling it for probably £35.
Well, I think a lot of the things with the idea of ownership and everything, with a car, you have, there's a physical thing. It's the idea of scarcity when you're talking about ownership. I mean, someday that car, like Charles said, it's going to wear out. You could sell it once, maybe you could sell it twice, maybe you could sell it 100 times, but at some point that car's not going to run anymore. With a game, I mean, you could sell it and 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 sell it. One person could buy it and sell it to 6 billion other people because it's not, I mean, as long as nobody breaks the disc in half or whatever, there's no scarcity for a digital item. If you go on the internet or whatever, if you buy a TV, there are X amount of TVs. If you buy a game off of Steam, there was no limit to the amount of those things that could be sold. You know what I mean? It's a different thing when there's a physical product involved or whatever. And like I said before, when you're buying a game, you're buying a disc and you're buying the license to play it. You're not buying the software on there. And the reason for that is because I've read that there's a whole separate thing where if you actually own the software, then you own the rights to do whatever you want with the software, like make changes to it and then resell it as its own product. There's a whole legal thing here that is just, it's beyond my pay grade, friends. I don't even want to get into it.
Yes, but you did raise an interesting point about how a digital economy changes the laws of supply and demand. That when it comes to digital distributors, supply is always precisely equal to demand.
Right, that's the thing. I mean, like, there's no shortage of Steam game. You could go on there. If you want to buy Booster Trooper right now, you can do it. There's not a limited amount of Booster Trooper. And if they had to sold that game as like a disc game, if there had been no digital option, there would absolutely be a shortage of Booster Trooper. There'd be 10 discs in the world, and that would be the only ones that had ever sold.
And this is also applying retroactively, where things that used to be collectible, if you wanted the Mac edition of some old BioWare game, you'd have to pay $80 to buy that on a physical disc. And of course, now you could just go on Steam or GOG, and you know, there it is in unlimited quantity.
Well, I feel like it kind of seems like we're coming across as saying, screw the used market. And I don't really feel like that's necessarily the case. Like, I feel like we should touch a little bit on some of the bad parts of if you got rid of it. And first of all, in my mind, one of the big things is that if there was no more used market tomorrow, at places like GameStop, they do not make money on new games. Like, I don't think they make 1 cent when they sell a brand new game. That's why they push the used game so hard. It's the only place they literally make any profit at all. And if you got rid of the used market, there are a lot of people who are just, I mean, they're just doing a job. They're just working there. They don't have any stock in the company or whatever. They're not the millionaires at the top making the decisions, and they're just going to be jobless. I mean, you could shut down GameStop tomorrow by saying that you cannot sell used things anymore. And there's a lot of people, that's a big con to me, is that there's just a lot of people who are just doing a job, minding their own business or whatever, who are going to be suddenly jobless after working there for maybe a long time, and they didn't do anything to deserve that.
I mean, there's a couple of things that you've touched on there. I mean, the first is that It's difficult to ascertain how much they actually make off of a new game. I've heard anywhere from, you know, like you say, practically nothing to $20. But it's neither here nor there, because for them, whether they make a cent or whether they make $20, they could make $55 by pushing a used copy. So that's what they're going to do. It comes down to whether or not the publishers would want to, and I don't know why they'd want to be honest, whether they'd want to split more fairly with the store selling if they had a guaranteed amount of sales. If they could say that, okay, we are definitely going to sell 3 million units and not 1 million new and 2 million used, they could say, well, okay, we'll give you a third more than you've had before. But given how long these companies have been selling games and not giving anything back to the publishers. I don't really see that there's anything in the publisher to do that. Secondly, I mean, things change. This is the thing that would be the bad, one of the cons of blocking the secondhand market is there would be people that would lose jobs because these companies that are making millions out of reselling games would be no longer able to do that. And so there is that downside. But at the same time, industries move on. You know, we closed the mines here 30 years ago, well, more than that, 40 years ago, and the economy bounced back. And that was on a huge scale. We changed the whole scope of our country in the matter of years. And I think that companies like Game and GameStop would be able to recover, you know, to a certain extent.
Well, it used to be that when you went to a comic book store, you didn't go there to buy new comics. You would go there to buy collectible back issues. And there were dedicated newsstands where you'd go to buy this month's issue of Superman. And then the comic book store itself was just there for rare collectibles. And I think if gaming stores could make a living if they just sell games and hardware, and particularly games that never went digital or games from previous generations that are hard to find even on a digital distributor. So it would be a different business model, and very much for a hardcore audience. But they wouldn't end up conflicting with toy stores, and they wouldn't have to worry about conflicting with the digital distribution system.
Here, it's interesting you make that point because that makes me think of something. In that one thing you didn't mention about the comic store is that I've gone. I mean, I'm a big nerd. I go to comic stores and everything. And the one thing that you didn't mention is the experience of going there. It's not just buying the old issues. It's you go in there and there's a bunch of guys sitting there. They're playing board games or whatever. They're, you know, having a laugh about some lame internet joke. They're looking at lolcats. You can talk to the guy who owns the shop, and he knows everything there is to know about all these different comics and games and everything. And it's just for, you know, for the right type of person, it's a cool atmosphere, I think. But there, I don't really think there is any of that for GameStop. It's just a store. You just go there and you just buy your thing. And I'm sure the people who work there know a lot about games, but they're too busy, you know, saying the corporate line that they have to say about, "Welcome to GameStop. Would you like to pre-order 40 new games?" So they'd put the money down on a used copy so you can bring it back and we can resell it and not give you any money for it. And it's like maybe that what we need is more places that are that sort of emulate the comic book model where they're, like you said, they're selling the older vintage stuff, and but they're also providing an experience, like you go there to be part of the atmosphere.
But you know, I mean, in the 90s, I can't really speak for the US, but here in the UK, in the 90s, there were stores like that. There were stores that were just kind of little rundown shops that would stick Sonic posters in the window and that would have just hundreds of games. And stores like Game and GameStation and GameStop came along and destroyed that whole thing. They came along and they just threw their money around and they became a household name that way. And now there are very few stores that can afford to do that. So would getting rid of GameStop and Game open up the market again to that sort of thing?
I think it definitely would, and I think that maybe some of the employees at your local GameStop and the other chain stores might end up working at these cool places because like you said they probably know a lot more about games than they're really letting on, and they're just firing off the tagline about do you want to pre-order Blood Killers 4?
Is there a chance, do you guys think that if it comes down the pipe and they say basically used games are a thing of the past, we're having always on consoles, we're not going to let you easily transfer ownership or whatever, is there a chance that a place like GameStop would just hit a switch and go in full reverse and become that type of store? Or do you think at this point the people in charge of it are just going to stubbornly cling to what they know and ride the ship down to the bottom of the ocean and then someone else will pick up the pieces?
I think you only have to look at Blockbusters and HMV to get the answer to that. You know, these places, they're not interested in changing to digital, and they're failing as a result. They've tried. They've kind of gone, okay, well, we'll have a streaming service, or you know, you can download for more online. But you know, when HMV was closing, I saw a comment. Someone said, "I go to HMV for the experience of going to a store. I don't want to buy online, have it delivered. I go to a store and I browse." But it doesn't change the fact that they're charging three times more than you can get the same item for online. And I don't think that the people who own these places want to change. They want people to come in and spend three times as much on the same item because it makes them a huge profit.
And because if you get them in the store,
that will know that they are changing.
Go ahead.
Well, I think the signal that will be that proves that they are willing to change is when they start offering to buy up used games from previous generations. So when GameStop is now suddenly buying your old N64 and PlayStation 1 games, you'll realize that they're gearing up to corner the market on those old commodities for a change in business plan.
You know, it's funny that you say that because I'm pretty sure a few months ago, Game here in the UK, who did just nearly go bust last year, actually started refusing to take PS2s in. I mean, the PS2, it's been out of, they've stopped making new ones for about 3 years now here, I think, maybe a little more. And now you cannot buy one new, you cannot buy one used, you can't buy any of the games without going online. And this is from a company that nearly disappeared 12 months ago.
Well, that would be a good sign that they're going to charge headlong into their grave.
The other sign for that is the fact that even on sale, they're charging more than anywhere else. It is terrible.
You talked about the whole, if GameStop turns around and starts selling vintage games. I actually saw something about that. There was a report on IGN probably 2 months ago or something that was about how GameStop is considering doing that, but it might be more of a, they take them in at the store and then just resell them online or something. But I don't know how it is where you are, Charles. I'm sure Matt doesn't have any. But there's a store around here, and I know it's on the West Coast, too. I know we've got at least two that I know of here in Michigan called Play and Trade. Do you have anything like that out in New York?
I don't think we have that exact chain. But tell me more about it.
Yeah, it's basically that thing we're all describing and sort of getting a little misty-eyed dreaming about, where you walk in, and it's set up similar to GameStop. They're typically not as big as a GameStop, and they're not as like loaded with brand new stuff. But they've got everything in there. You can walk in there, you can buy a PS3 game and a copy of Super Mario Brothers 2. And the ones that are set up by me, they have a bunch of different screens set up, and it's like on one of them they've got an Xbox 360, and you can play BioShock Infinite or whatever. Across the way, someone's playing Yoshi's Island on Super Nintendo, and next to him, another guy's playing Metroid on an original Nintendo or whatever, and they're selling every type of game from every generation that has ever existed. You can go in there and buy an Atari and a 3DS at the same time and walk out with both, and it's cool. It's really cool. And the people who work there, they're not, you know, they do a little bit of the corporate stuff the same way, but they're out there, they're goofing off, playing the games with people, they're having fun and everything. I think every other week, every time a new game comes out that has a multiplayer element, they're doing a tournament at midnight, and the winner of that tournament usually gets to take a free copy of the new game home. It's a cool place. I really should go there more.
Well, we don't have a chain that does that, but there are a few little stores hidden around the city. It's just a privately owned game shop, and, you know, they're floor to ceiling with cases of old consoles and old games and old controllers and memorabilia. So we do have that, but it's not quite such an organized chain.
I know, yeah, I think I want to encourage people to go out into your city and find the little stores where they are still doing this. And there's a lot of people who are probably not going to be able to find them, unfortunately. But I know I have one, I forget what it's called offhand. I wish I knew because I'd like to give them a little bit of props here. Maybe I can do it in the show notes or something. But you walk in and, I mean, it is just vintage games. Some things still new in the box. I tell you, when I see an NES action system in the box, it makes my knees weak. I remember getting that for Christmas. I was 3 years old when I got that thing. And it changed my life. And now, see, I always have wanted to go back and buy that thing in the box. I get a little misty-eyed even just talking about it. That NES action set in the box, man.
I kind of feel like we've been around to be another pro of blocking it. The only downside that I can think of in regards to blocking the used industry is that it would give the publishers complete domination over the way that we buy titles. And I mean, that sounds like it could be a very, very bad thing, and it sounds like it could be a good thing, but until it actually happens, we won't know. People are judging it based on the industry as it is today, where there's DLC and where digital prices are so high. But you have to realize that the reason that DLC is what it is, and the reason that microtransactions are so huge, and that all these bad things about the industry as it is now came as a result of the fact that they can't afford to make games the way they used to. People want AAA titles with fantastic graphics and really well-planned multiplayer and huge epic stories, but they don't want to pay any more for it. And I feel that the biggest risk of going of blocking the used market is that the publishers might not know that they don't have to do that anymore.
I think if they were to kill the used market, if they just came right out and they said, okay, used is dead or whatever, then what I want to see is I want to see publishers with a strong show of good faith right away saying, okay, it is impossible to buy this game used, so here's the price on DLC, and it's significantly less than what we pay now, because the argument that a lot of people have heard is that they charge so much for DLC because they want to make some money on the person who bought it used. If buying used is not an issue anymore, then I want to see that price come down, down, down. But I worry that that is not going to happen.
Well, there's also issues of unsuccessful games that a particular player might want to play. And there's also game companies that go out of business or that have legal issues. So, for example, System Shock 2. You could not buy a new or digital copy of System Shock 2 until it just hit good old games.com a couple of months ago. And you know, the same is true for some other game companies that have gone out of business and their products just aren't available anywhere except buying a used game.
And I do think there's going to have to be ways of dealing with that, even if it's just making. I mean, we've seen with THQ that a lot of things have disappeared off digital stores, but they're going to start reappearing. And I think the important thing to ensure is, and this is kind of on the part of the console, the brand, is that they have to ensure that there are things in place in case that happens, so that they can keep it on the store until someone else buys it. We saw with THQ again that Sony just didn't know where to send the money, so after a couple of weeks it just disappeared off the store. Before then they were selling it dirt cheap in a deal, but as soon as that deal ended it disappeared off the store, and it's not going to come up again until Sega or whoever re-release it.
Right. Yeah. I don't know. It's a problem.
Yeah, Silicon Knights had a similar problem where they made several games without buying the license that they should have. And so a couple games made by them were ordered, pulled off the shelves, and you know, retailers were supposed to burn all the copies. And hypothetically, you're not supposed to be able to get a copy of these games anywhere. But you know, if you go into the right used game store, you know, there they are. And that's only because you know, maybe someone at GameStop is cheating, or your local privately owned store decided to keep them just for their collectability.
But I don't necessarily that this is something that we should have to worry about. This is something that the developers should be better on top of. And I think that if we went all digital or if we got rid of the used market, that's something that they would have to address.
Right.
Well, I feel like we have run long here. Talking about this, and I don't think we've resolved anything. Is there anything, do either of you guys want to mention anything quickly about the used market before we sort of wrap it up?
I think that from what we've just spoke about, we all seem fairly positive that it's not going to be the end of the world if the used market disappears. And I think that's what I was trying to get across in my article from the other day as well. If the used market disappears, gaming's going to carry on. It's us that's going to have to adjust. All these people that are moaning, if that happens, I'm getting out of this hobby. You're going to have to get out of the hobby. It's going to happen at some point, whether we go full digital or whether they block the used market. And you know, it's not going to be the end of the industry. It's not going to be the end of our hobby, and we're still going to enjoy it regardless.
Yeah, it seems like this argument's been around for the entire last console generation, and the industry seems to have anticipated and is slowly adapting so that when it happens, they're still going to be able to stay in business, and they'll ensure that they keep their customer base too.
I guess for most people, it just comes down to the idea of ownership. When you buy something, should you be allowed to resell it versus when somebody makes a game, do they absolutely deserve to get some money for it? And to be honest, I'm not sure that there is a right answer to that overall. I mean, obviously you want people who are making games to get paid, but if you buy something, you want to feel like it's yours and you can do what you like with it. And apparently these two things are kind of at odds with each other, but like we seem to agree on, we know which way it's heading. I mean, it's sort of not worth crying about now. And in the end, I think we will find that in the end, it turns out, if not entirely positively, then certainly not as bad as the naysayers and doom speakers are thinking. Well, I think that is about it from us this week. Thanks for joining me, gents.
Cheers.
Good to be here.
All right, we will be back next week with episode 6 and hopefully the special BioShock episode. Until then, we are out.